Welcome to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. This is episode 62. We are still in Exodus and will be for some time. I'm Daniel Emery Price. I'm joined by Chad Bird, who is in Texas, but not in Dallas, Texas, which me and him were both in Dallas, Texas just last weekend. And now we're back. We were there for the city event, and that was a good time, Chad.
It was. We had a great time. Great turnout. Great presentations. Just a fantastic chance to get together with folks around the word and to enjoy some time together.
Yeah,
it was,
man.
Fun.
Yeah, yeah. So we're gonna be leaking that content out over the next couple weeks as we edit it all up and stuff. But one thing that that happened there was we were able to announce a different conference that's coming up. So we always got some conference coming up. We never don't have a conference coming up, some event.
This is a big conference.
So this is like the granddaddy of all events that we've done. This is next October in San Diego, California, for the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Christel Fast is one of the sponsors of the Here We Still Stand conference, which is going to be 3 days long. There's 20 plus presenters. It's going to be incredible. Me and Chad will both be there, along with everyone that you can think of that you would want to be there. I mean, I'm not even going to run through all the names, but they're all there. And you can go over to herewestillstand.org, and you can go over there and see who all is going to be there, what all is going to be going on. But this is the thing you got to know. Because it's in honor of the Reformation, and because of Luther's 95 Theses, if you register right now, you can register for $95. And that $95 includes all the sessions, all your meals, dessert bar, after parties, the whole thing. It includes the whole everything that you could possibly do at this event, like food, beverage, sessions, all that. You can figure out the rest of it later. Figure out the plan later. Get over there to herewestillstand.org. Register now. $95 gets you the whole thing. We're losing money here like crazy, and we don't care. So you should do it.
Yeah, man, that's a steal. That's to get all of that for $95. So register now. We'd love to have you all there.
That's it. All right. We won't waste your time. I know you guys love that we just jump right in. So, but that's important because we love you and we want to see you there. Chad, where we leave off in the story of the Exodus.
We're about halfway through chapter one of Exodus. We got to lay some groundwork here before we really go full steam ahead through the story. So we talked a little bit about Exodus just kind of in general as a book, kind of gave a kind of a basic outline of how the story shapes up. And some of the major themes that we see traced through the whole story of Exodus. So we did that. And then we got started with the book itself, made it through those first 14 verses. And we kind of went from a high point to a low point already in these opening verses, because we start out with kind of a recap. So it tells how many of the sons of Jacob went down into Egypt, and that generation eventually got old, they died, but that God richly blessed the Israelites in Egypt. You have this piling up of verbs in verse 7, that they were fruitful, they increased greatly, they multiplied, they were exceedingly mighty, the land was just filled with them. So everything's going great, and then all of a sudden, everything doesn't go great. We have this reversal that takes place, because there's a new Pharaoh that takes the throne. And he is frightened of the Israelites, because there's so many of them, and he's afraid that if a foreign army invades Egypt, that the Israelites will join up with these invaders, and then together they're going to be able to conquer Egypt. So what does he do? Well, he implements a plan, and the first step in this plan is that he more or less enslaves the Israelites. He appoints taskmasters over them to afflict them, and this doesn't work. In fact, it backfires, because it says the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied. So Pharaoh's plan doesn't work. The exact opposite worked. And so he continues to make their lives bitter through harsh labor, through slavery, through building projects, through all of this kind of stuff. And so that takes us through verse 14. We're going to pick up today is kind of the next step in his plan. And this next step is the worst step, because failing to really kill the spirit of the Israelites by forced servitude, he instead opts to actually kill all of the male offspring who are born. And this is kind of a two-step process that that we have here. First he's going to try and do it sort of secretly, without any kind of public decree that this is what's supposed to happen. So picking up here at verse 15, we're introduced to a couple of midwives. And depending on your translation, it probably calls them Hebrew midwives, where it's a little bit unclear as to whether these are like Egyptian midwives that served the Hebrew people, or whether they were actually Hebrew midwives who served their fellow Hebrew people. So a little bit of ambiguity there. The ancient Greek translation called the Septuagint opted for saying that these were actually Egyptian midwives who served the Hebrew people. But the Hebrew itself is unclear, but that's beside the point. They're midwives, and they're serving the Hebrew women. And we have their names, which is significant. One was named Shipra, and the other was named Puah. The reason this is significant is because it's sort of a slap in the face to the high and mighty of the day. Because throughout this whole story, we are never told the name of the Egyptian pharaoh, even though everybody would have known that. He was revered as a god incarnate, so everyone would have known Pharaoh and his name. But the biblical writer purposefully leaves that out. He remains unnamed. So his significance is extremely lowered because of this. And we do know the name of these two common, ordinary, everyday, working Hebrew midwives. And the fact that we know their names and not the name of the Egyptian pharaoh at the time it strikes a theme that we're going to see throughout the scriptures. We've already seen it in the book of Genesis as well, and that is that the Bible has this way of directing our attention to that which we would really never focus our attention on according to our everyday perspective. Because what the Bible does, what God does in the scriptures, is he constantly focusing us not toward the things that we and the world think are our best. I mean, what do we look up to? We look up to people with money. We look up to people with power. We look up to people who are smart. So wealth and power and wisdom. The ancient world venerated these, and the modern world venerates these as well. And yet what God does is he chooses that which is foolish to shame the wise. He chooses that which is weak to shame the strong. He chooses that which is poor to shame the rich. So he's constantly reversing our expectations of how he should act. So you can pretty much say that, whatever you think God should do, he's going to do the exact opposite. Whatever you think God should say, he's going to say the exact opposite, because he doesn't work according to our ways of thinking. He doesn't look up to the same things that we look up to. Instead, he looks down. He looks on the poor. He looks on the lowly. He looks on the common. And so we see that in the case of these Hebrew midwives, because God is looking upon them. He's exalting them. He's giving names to them. And yet the high and mighty and wealthy ruler of Egypt, we don't even know his name. I mean, he comes out sort of as a buffoon in this story, because here he is meeting with Hebrew midwives, trying to enlist them in this act of genocide that he has planned. And yet they fool him, as we're going to see in just a second. So he can't even initiate a plan that's going to work. Everything backfires against him. So the fact that we know the names of these Hebrew midwives is all part of kind of this way in which the scripture directs us to ultimately to the cross, where God works through the foolishness of the cross, the weakness of the cross, the shame of the cross, in order to reveal his glory. So the naming of these women is part of that whole theology of the cross that's woven throughout the scriptures. So Pharaoh calls them in, and he says to them, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it's a son, then you shall put them to death. But if it's a daughter, then she shall live. So this is where he's taking it up a notch, the oppression of the Israelites, because now we have an act of genocide in which he wants the midwives basically to do something secretly to the male children when they're being born so that they die, but it doesn't appear as if they are killing them. That's kind of the plan here. So he wants this to be in secret, but he wants the midwives to carry it out in order that the growth of the Israelites might be stifled. So if it's a son, they live. If it's a daughter, if it's a son, he's put to death. If it's a daughter, then she lives. Now, one of the ironies here, and there's a lot of ironies in these opening chapters of Exodus. One of these ironies is that actually it's the daughters of Israel. It's the women of Israel who end up thwarting the plan of Pharaoh, as we're going to see in chapter 2. So by letting the daughters live, Pharaoh is actually undermining his whole endeavor, because it's the women who are going to be used by God to save Moses, for instance. So all of Pharaoh's plans are coming unraveled in one way or another. Now, when the midwives are told this, we are told right away a significant thing about them. It says they feared God. And because of that, because of their fear of God, the reverence of God, their belief in him, they acted according to what God would have them do instead of what Pharaoh commanded them to do. So this is kind of what we would call today an act of civil disobedience. It says they did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but they let the boys live. They obeyed God rather than men. Well, when the king finds out about this, he calls the midwives in and he begins an interrogation of them. He says, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? And the midwives are smart. Now, they're not going to tell Pharaoh outright what they've done. Instead, they act in a way which is cunning. They say to him, here's the reason that this has all happened. It's because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, because they're vigorous. They give birth before the midwife can get to them. So the midwives are saying, listen, we know what you told us to do, but look, we might be summoned that the Israelite woman is in labor, but before we can even get there, she's already given birth, because the Israelite women are more vigorous and more lively than the Egyptian women. They're stronger than the Egyptian women. So they're really, our hands are tied. There's nothing we can do. It's not like we can kill the male child after he's already been born. So no matter what you tell us to do, it's not working, because the Israelites are the way they are. The Israelite women are the way they are.
Well, that's a weird thing.
That is a weird thing. The compliment, you mean?
That's a weird compliment. First of all, birthing stools are that's a weird thing.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what those are, but I can't imagine them being comfortable, whatever they are.
The birthing stool sounds like a toilet. Like, it seems like you need to have a hole in this thing where, like, the baby, like, drops. I don't know what to see. It's things like this that make reading the Bible weird.
Yeah. Well, literally, it's two stones, and so maybe the way these two stones were put together allowed for that. I don't know. I'm not acquainted with the ancient Egyptian art with regard to childbirth.
Maybe so, it's I'm maybe not sure. It's like the my mind immediately went. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen this. I'm about to derail this whole thing. I don't know if you've ever seen the advertisement for the squatty potty, but it seems like. She's like, that's what's in my mind. It's like, this will make everything easier. Maybe I don't know, ladies. Maybe you've been doing this wrong the whole time. I don't know, but it's still, this is a weird compliment. Like, hey, these Hebrew women, they just keep barren kids doesn't even faze them. Like, that doesn't even faze them, man. They just, by the time we get there, it's done. The kid's like grown up by the time we get there. That's weird.
Yeah, it is a weird compliment.
And it's no wonder he doesn't have anything to say to that, because no dude has anything to say to that.
Yeah, what's a guy going to say? He's going to be like, no, that can't happen.
Yeah. So a dude just could be like, oh, okay. So, like, I mean, these women are smart in the sense that they're going to, we'll just say something about bearing children. He won't be able to say anything, you know? And that's exactly how that goes. It just kind of stops your mouth, and you got to be like, okay. I mean, when my wife tells me something about labor, I don't argue.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, this is like one of those ancient subjects that it's still the same for guys today, right? You just can't comment on it. If that's what a woman says, then you just say amen. I believe you.
That's right.
No commentary is going to come from a man on this.
Yeah, sometimes I will. If I hurt myself, I'll be like, "I'm telling you, it's like worse than childbirth." Just to see,
what kind of reaction you're gonna get.
And then my wife's a very gracious person, and I get like this flash, this look that says I don't know what I'm talking about.
I'm sure you do. Well, at least you have a week in the doghouse to think about it. Right.
Okay, now that we've derailed that, I just want to point out the weirdness. That's what I'm here for. I'm here to point out the weird nuances. So let's continue. Hey,
that's fine. There's a lot of weird things in the scriptures. We just will point them out as we're jogging along here. Well, what kind of to pick up the story then. So that was the conversation. Pharaoh didn't press the point. Smart guy. And here's what happened to the midwives. It says, so God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. And it came about because the midwives feared God that he established households for them. There's an ancient Jewish tradition that the women that served as midwives, or those who were unable to bear children of their own, and they use this verse as an explanation for that. It's a tradition. But I suppose that's a possibility. Either way, one of the ways in which God rewarded these women for their fidelity is by giving them households. And the Israelites continued to multiply. They kept on having babies and more babies. And so everything that Pharaoh tried wasn't working. He's tried oppressing them. He's tried enslaving them. Now he tried forcing the midwives to commit infanticide. That didn't work. So what's he going to do? Well, it's sort of the last culminating step in this process that Pharaoh has been going through. We get to the very end of chapter 1, and here's what he says. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, and not just the midwives, and not secretly, but now we have a public decree. Every son who was born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. So no more of this kind of, you know, behind the scenes and backroom kind of stuff going on where he tries to talk the midwives into killing the male children. And so this becomes a public decree. It's official policy of genocide, basically. And presumably then this is everybody. If you're an Egyptian, you're supposed to enforce this. If you're an Israelite, you're supposed to self-enforce it. Every child who was born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. Now, since we know the whole story of the book of Exodus, this verse is significant because this sets the stage for what we're going to see later on as the story develops. For one thing, here we have the killing of the sons of the Israelites at the hand of the Egyptians. And this is going to be reflected when we get to chapter 12, when you have the firstborn sons of the Egyptians themselves being killed when the avenging angel comes through on the night of the Passover. So that it comes full circle. And so just as the Egyptians tried to kill did kill the male children of the Israelites, so their own male firstborn sons are going to be killed on the 10th plague, the night of the Passover. But not only that, go ahead, Dan.
I was going to say, I'm about to steal your point, probably. I think that there's an obvious foreshadowing here of Herod killing, you know, the infant boys up to 2 years old. You sort of have this deliverer is born, right? And so Herod goes on this murderous rampage and kills all these infant boys. And you have this, I mean, Exodus as a sort of foreshadow of the great Exodus that Christ brings about, the Exodus from sin and death. You have the same thing happen here, where Moses ends up being preserved, like Christ was preserved, through the slaying of, like, all his brethren.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on here. If you compare the infancy narratives of Moses with the infancy narrative of Jesus, you're going to see multiple parallels, and that's one of them. And you have a lot of when Herod issues his decree that all the male children in Bethlehem are to be slaughtered. Well, they are, but Jesus escapes, and you have the death of all of these Israelite boys in the Nile River, and yet Moses is rescued. And I mean, it continues too, because Jesus ends up in Egypt. Just like Moses was in Egypt. So you got the life of Moses laying the foundation for our understanding of the life of Jesus, which is interesting, because there's all sorts of parallels between Moses and Jesus, but also there's this great contrast between them, because the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So you've got a parallel of their lives, and yet, as with all these kind of biblical parallels or biblical types, you have Christ as a fulfillment of that, taking it to the next level, or contrasting with it in some way. But yeah, I mean, everything that happens in the Nile River with Moses and with Pharaoh and everything coming up here, that is a foreshadowing of what's going to happen with the Messiah. That's one of the many ways in which Exodus is pointing forward to the fulfillment that we have in Christ, in individuals as well as kind of the whole basic pattern of the book, where you have enslavement and rescue and redemption through water, and then finally entrance into the Holy Land.
Yeah, and I think in a real way, I think that you can consider certainly in the children that Herod kills, but I think even here, I do think that it's okay to call these children martyrs.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're witnesses, which is what a martyr is. Martyr means witness. They're witness to the fact that they are the people of God, and yet they are being oppressed by this foreign ruler, and actually giving their lives as a witness to the fact that they are of the people of Israel, the chosen people of God.
Yeah, that's a pretty horrific scene.
Yeah, it's one of those. I think. One of the problems that we have, if we know the biblical story very well, is that the shock of what's happening here is sometimes lost on us. You know, if you've heard a story over and over and over in the scriptures, then the shock value of that story begins to wear over time. But this is a horrendous, really bloodthirsty decree. And I mean, if you're a father or mother, or even if you're not, just imagine holding a child in your arms, standing at the banks of the Nile River, commanded to throw that child in and to drown in those waters. It's just heart-wrenching to imagine what the Israelites were going through, and especially when this was the public decree that this was to happen to every male Israelite child.
Yeah, I mean, I think also, I mean, at this point, the Israelites are, a few million people.
This is widespread, nationally sponsored murder that's taking place.
Yeah, I mean,
a lot of people.
Yeah, and so you're talking about in a time before birth control, and we've already established that the Israelites are, the Jews are multiplying like crazy. I mean, I don't think this is like a couple of kids thrown in the Nile. I mean, I think you're talking about a lot of death going on here. I mean, the Nile, I mean, that's got to be a mess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time. You've got, well, of course, we're never told how many, how extensive this was. And certainly there were probably many who tried, like the mother of Moses, to prevent it from happening. But however long this took place and however many people were affected, this was a catastrophic disaster on the part of the Israelites. And it's what is leading us up to something that we're going to hear at the end of chapter 2, where the sons of Israel are crying out to God because of everything that they've been going through. And also, in many ways, kind of it sets the stage, as I mentioned earlier, for what's going to happen to the sons of the Egyptians. And they have done this to the Israelites, and then it's going to be turned back around on themselves on the night of the Passover.
I think there's something crazy if you look at the imagery of, we're jumping a little bit ahead here, but with Moses, just talking about the Nile, and he's put in a basket, and is put in the Nile, right? I mean, like, so he's put in the Nile, and he's like floating in this basket. But he's floating down like this river of death, where who knows how many, but you must assume a whole lot of his kinsmen have, his brothers and sisters, as it were, have met their death. And this is a crazy scene.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a scene of gore and sorrow and oppression. I mean, the whole thing, it's like a basically like a watery graveyard that Moses is put into. Let's jump into that. Let's see what happens with Moses. We're at the beginning of chapter 2. So we have the decree: every son born cast to the Nile, every daughter is alive. So now we have this kind of, this real broad perspective. This was what's to happen to the whole nation of the Israelites. And now we're going to focus in on this one particular family with one particular child. We're told that there was a couple. They were both of the house of Levi. We're not told their names here. We're going to learn the names just a few chapters down. In chapter 6, we're told their names are Amram and Jochebed. So they're married, and she gets pregnant, and she has a son. Now you can imagine what kind of anxiety her pregnancy would have caused, because if it's a son, of course she knows what the decree is. If it's a daughter, then she lives. But she bears a son. And it's very interesting here. I got to point this out, because I think this tells us a lot about kind of the whole, what kind of undergirds this whole story. It says, when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. Now, let me explain this a little bit. It's literally in the Hebrew, it doesn't say when she saw that he was beautiful or that he was handsome or whatever. Literally in the Hebrew, it says when she saw that he was good, she hid him for 3 months. Now, the reason this is significant is because this word for good, which in Hebrew is tov, is the same word that we have back in Genesis 1 that's found over and over and over. God made everything on day 1, it was good. Day 2, it was good, so on and so forth, all the way through day 7, when everything is pronounced as tov ma'od, which is very good. So this word that she saw that he was tov is one of the ways in which the storyteller is connecting what happens here with Moses with what happened back in Genesis 1. It infuses the story of Moses with this theme of creation. It's almost as if this is the narrator's way of winking to us that what we have happening here is a new kind of creation, a new act in which the creative work of God is going to be manifested. The creative work of God, which is also exhibited in these saving ways. So there's this great intimate connection between creation and redemption. Redemption is basically God's way of restoring creation to the way it should be. So what God is doing in Moses is an act of redemption, But more than that, it's an act of recreation. Because you remember the way Genesis 1 begins, you have the whole earth flooded with water. And there's no organization to it. It's tohu vavohu, as the Hebrew says. It's formless and void, water all over everything. Well, once again, we have water. We have the water that is filled with death itself here in the Nile in Egypt. And now we have a son. We have a boy who is Tov. He's good. Now, however you want to explain that or translate that, he is connected with God's creative work back in Genesis 1. And it's through him that God is going to bring about a new creation for the Israelites. He's going to bring them out of this death trap that they're in. And he's going to bring them into the freedom and liberation that they're going to experience in the Exodus. So she hides her baby boy for 3 months. She sees that he is Tov, which sets the stage for what is to follow. So at 3 months old, she can't hide any longer. So she makes a basket out of papyrus, which was plants that grew all along the Nile. They actually made rafts and boats out of papyrus in ancient Egypt. So she makes a little basket and covers it with tar and pitch and puts a child in it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. Now, this is one of those verses we can't just blaze past, because what happens here is it's like you've got all sorts of other biblical stories that are informing our understanding of what's happening here. So we've already jumped from this story to Genesis chapter 1 with the whole creation theme. Now we jump ahead to the whole story of Noah and the ark. It says that she made this basket for her baby boy, covered it with tar and pitch. Well, throughout the Old Testament, there is only the Hebrew word that's used here, a noun, which is teva. Teva is only used in two stories in the whole Old Testament. This one, to describe this little basket boat that Moses is placed into. And that's the same word that's translated as ark in the story of Noah and the flood. So the two occurrences in the Old Testament of teva or ark are found here and then in the flood narrative. So not only do you have all the whole story of creation informing this, but also you have Moses is presented here as kind of a second Noah. Just like Noah was set adrift upon the chaos of the waters in the flood, so Moses is set adrift in these waters of death. He covered the ark with tar and pitch, and so this little bitty ark that Moses is placed in is covered in tar and pitch as well. So you got the creation themes, you got the Noah and the ark and the flood themes that are informing the story of Moses. And there's one more. There's a look ahead too, because it says that his mother put him at the Nile by the reeds that grew along the bank. And this word for reeds is the same word that's going to come up later in the description of the Red Sea, where where the Egyptians and Pharaoh will be drowned. Literally, in Hebrew, the Red Sea is the Sea of Reeds, Yom Suf. So a suf is a reed. And it's the same word that's used here in chapter 2. So you got reeds that are going to be at the Red Sea. You got reeds that are here at the Nile River. She places him there, and Moses is going to be saved, but Pharaoh and the Egyptians at the Sea of Reeds or the Red Sea later will not be saved. Will in fact be punished by God with drowning. Now the reason I bring all that up is because I think it's significant, because this story, the language that's used in this story, is intended to be read in concert with a whole lot of other stories. So it's not isolated. It's all part of this whole biblical framework that you see back in Genesis with creation and the flood, and looking forward to what happens at the Red Sea. So everything that's happening with Moses here, with baby Moses here, is connecting us in one way or another to God's redemptive and creative work in other parts of the scriptures.
Yeah, and so as we know, as Peter tells us, that the ark, right, is a type of Christ. So it's a thing you got to be in, right? Mm-hmm. To live, you have to be placed in the ark of Christ to do this. And I think that there's this crazy thing that happens here, and maybe it's a stretch, but I think I've always thought it's cool, where you have Moses, who represents the law. You have the law placed in the ark. So you have the law placed in Christ, sailing down this river of death, which is pretty awesome.
That is pretty awesome. That's quite an image. Yeah. You got the law resting inside the ark of Christ, floating down the river of death. I love it. Yeah, I don't think it's a stretch at all. I mean, if you look at this story, like I was doing a minute ago, from the whole biblical perspective, which is what you got to do. You can't just, you know, cut out a little passage and look at it in isolation. The whole, all 66 books are unity. They're a body. It's like our own body is all joined together. So all of these stories are joined together. And so when you look at it from that perspective, then yeah, it's not a stretch at all. Actually, it makes perfect sense. So just gotta set the stage here. So we've got a land full of death. You got a river full of death. You got oppressed Israelites. You've got a mother who's scared to death for the life of her 3-month-old baby boy. You've got Pharaoh who is just bloodthirsty for the Israelites. I mean, and you've got this little baby in a tiny basket floating in a river that's full of death, that's full of crocodiles, it's full of all these things that are against it. Now, everything about this would scream that there is absolutely zero hope for anything to come of this. I mean, everything on the surface of this says that the future of the people of Israel hangs by a thread. And this thread is wearing thin, even thinner by the moment. Everything seems to be against it. It seems as if, you know, absolutely nothing is going to come of this. And this then is the perfect setup for God, because God loves lost causes. God loves situations where we would say, oh, no, no way. Nothing's going to happen here. It's going to fall flat in its face. When God begins something, it always seems as if nothing will come of it. And that's exactly what's happening here. So this story is so much like what continues to happen in the life of the church and in our lives as well. When it seems as if there is absolutely, you know, no hope, that is the perfect opportunity for God to step in and to do his best work. When it seems as if nothing's going to happen, that's the perfect opportunity for God to step in and to do his work, because he does his best work with nothing. We know that from Genesis chapter 1. He creates everything from nothing, and that's the way he continues to work in our world. He prefers to work with nothing. That's how he does his best work. Like, it's like the more that's there, the less God works. The less it's there, the more God works, because that's the way he exhibits his grace and his power, is by working in this vacuum that he fills with surprising acts of grace and redemption.
That's it. And we're going to have to leave Moses right there in the basket. We're going to have to come and find him next week. So, guys, Christ Hold Fast, this podcast, everything we do, it's all listener-supported stuff. So if you find it helpful and you'd like to help us out, we really could use the help. You can go over to ChristHoldFast.org, go over to support, and you can support us there. And that would go a long way to help us continuing to do the stuff that we do. And we really appreciate those of you who have done that. Also, if you're over there, you will see some links. You'll see some links that would take you over to Here We Still Stand. You can get all that conference information, and you should definitely consider that. Chad, we will catch up next week.
All right, we'll be back.